What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Anirban Roy, who's head of strategy at Wieden and Kennedy in India. He's based in Delhi. We're going to be talking about the relationship between strategists and people in the creative team, or people in the strategy department and people in the creative department. And it's been super interesting background. I mean, currently head of strategy at Wieden and Kennedy for a year. You've been head of planning in Delhi for McCann. Head of strategic planning in Bengaluru, Ogilvy. You've worked in the Philippines, vice president of strategic planning. Like, you're a real career strategist. Did you think that this was going to be the career that you'd end up with when you started out?
Actually not, Mark, to be honest. Advertising happened by accident and not by design. So yeah, I never planned for it.
Where did you think you would end up?
Yeah, I actually wanted to be an academician. So I was doing my PhD up in England. And I wanted to be a professor in English studies, but life had other plans, clearly.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, the most common story that I've heard from India, and I know it's a massive country, so it sounds silly to actually say that as if it's like a monolithic place. But one of the most common stories I've heard from people in advertising, and especially strategists, is a little bit different from where they started studying. Often, say, engineering, for example, is quite a common story that I hear. Studied engineering, parents wanted me to, and then later I found out about advertising. I haven't met or interviewed that many people who started off studying literature, for example, and then ended up in advertising in India. Am I making up what I'm saying? Because I feel like I've heard it from tens of people.
No, what you're saying is absolutely true. I think it's an accurate representation. Very diverse backgrounds when it comes to the kind of talent that this industry attracts in this country. And yes, oftentimes, you know, a lot of people who chose science as an option versus humanities tend to kind of gravitate after doing that for a bit and come to this industry to, I guess, unlock their creative DNA.
Very cool. Wieden & Kennedy in Delhi, what kind of work are you doing? How big are you? Wouldn't mind talking about that for a little bit.
So Wieden & Kennedy Delhi has been around for quite some time, I think 16, 17 years now in India, if I'm not mistaken. Mostly like with all the other countries where Wieden is present, known for creating and doing some work which is slightly off the playbook in many sense. So we are known for creating brands that have a very distinct voice, right? A case in point, in the past we've done for Indigo Airlines. That's India's number one airline at the moment. Today we work for India's largest 5G telco operator, Jio. Again, a great case of trying to unlock the power of brand voice for them. We also work for an EV brand called Vida from Hero Motor Corp, which is, I think, the world's largest two-wheeler manufacturer, if I'm not mistaken. Some new age brands look after Asia's largest branded dental chain called Clove Dental. So very, very interesting work in the pipeline and in the mix.
Mm-hmm. How big is the company?
In India, I think between, if I put together Delhi and Mumbai together, we'd be about 80, 90 odd people.
You know, you've been in the industry for over 20 years, but in the past 2 to 3 years, what's changed in the kinds of relationships you're having with clients and the kinds of projects that are coming through the front door?
I think overall, there's been a lot of fragmentation in how clients are spending money, right? Earlier, it was, you know, approach a creative agency, put something on TV, at best press, outdoor, and, you know, get on with it. I think the whole digital wave has, you know, truly arrived, much like in many parts of the world, even more so in India. I think the entire COVID event kind of accelerated digital adoption in this country across multiple kind of touch points and sectors and industry, whether it's, you know, fintech, food tech, edutech, game tech, whatever. It's all digital first. I think that has kind of given momentum to clients now parking a lot of budgets in digital advertising, and not just bottom of the funnel programmatic kind of conversation, but also using digital to build top of the funnel conversations and drive fame and awareness. So that's one big change that I see. And I think in terms of relationships with clients, I think that hasn't changed much, except for the fact that I think their business has even got more complicated because of all this technology explosion that keeps happening at multiple fronts, especially in a country like India, where erstwhile, we weren't that big in terms of smartphone and internet penetration, but now that's catching up very, very fast. So there's been an entire generation that actually leapfrogged from a desktop to a mobile, never getting into a laptop kind of a mode. They just went from a desktop straight onto a mobile that was internet enabled. And now with 5G coming into the question, that is also, you know, kind of changing a lot of things. I think clients are opening up in terms of the possibilities of technology and everything that lies at the intersection of data and technology. That's pretty much the playbook at international award forums like Cannes as well. So India is also belting out similar stuff.
And then between the two offices, how many strategists would you have?
So we have overall five strategists. So two in Delhi, two in Mumbai, and this myself who's kind of helping the team.
5 out of 80. I get asked questions, and I work with companies a bit where we're looking at like ratios, just as rules of thumb, because in a lot of places there are definitely not enough strategists and definitely not enough time allocated to research or strategy. And on that point, do your strategists do much research?
Yes, they do. I mean, we obviously have clients who also believe in kind of commission second party research when it comes to the quantitative stuff. But we do a lot of qualitative research. And by that, I don't just mean desk work or desk research via social listening and stuff like that. We do that as well. But I think the good old practice of spending time with consumers in their natural habitat still has its own merits. It bears fruit. It gives us rich anecdotes, inspiration to kind of feed into the creative engine. And that's something that we vouch for and like to spend time on.
I want to talk about the main topic that brought us together, which I saw you write about on LinkedIn recently, which was to get into the relationship dynamics between strategists and creatives. I struggle with calling people creatives. I struggle with it. Largely because when you work with people who are in the creative department, they love to say, as a creative, I've got friends who are in this space, so I'm teasing a little bit. As a creative. I'm like, why do you keep having to say that in every single conversation? I'm like, I don't want to use it as a verb to describe a person anymore. But let's talk about this because you've got some good thoughts on it. How many, I'm going to use the word creative in the way that I don't really want to use it. It's going to trigger me every single time. How many creatives do you think you've worked with over your career?
That's a tough question. I don't know, probably more than 500.
And of the 500, how many of those relationships do you sort of still recall in a really positive way? How many of those relationships do you cherish? How many of those relationships? It's a silly question because, you know, we're trying to pretend that there's a way to quantify something that you haven't counted. How many of those people did you feel close to? Did you feel that you're doing great work with?
I would say 15 or 20 out of 500.
Yeah, that's super interesting, isn't it? Okay. Now, when you think through those 15 to 20 people, what made it work?
I don't think there's a silver bullet kind of an answer to that question because, you know, every human being and every creative or every account management or every strategist is very, very unique in their own ways. But I did kind of notice some patterns, perhaps, if you will, of between those relationships that I really cherish and still kind of recall, and that has helped me to grow. And kind of when I was working with them, it was a very fulfilling and meaningful partnership. And I think some of the patterns that emerge, one is an absolute sense of friendship and partnership that we are in it together, irrespective of where that creative person was or I was in the food chain, right? So it was not necessarily a hierarchical conversation that, you know, I'm only talking to my peers or, you know, I need to talk to somebody who's very senior in the department. But irrespective of the designations and the hierarchy, there was an absolute sense of trust and friendship that we're in this together. We're a team that helped break down barriers, that helped break down egos, that helped build kind of trust. And oftentimes, they actually played outside of the advertising agency, by which I mean not necessarily within the walls of the building that we were working in. So spending time outside there, yeah, having a drink, having coffee, having lunch, just going for a walk, going for a run, just doing silly things that have perhaps nothing to do with advertising was actually that fed into the relationship and, you know, kind of helped us come close, which is, I guess, how normal relationships work.
Yeah, it's funny. On that second one, I've spent a lot of time around youth soccer or youth football, and there's a bit of research that looks at who passes to whom on the field for young kids, and it's typically people that they're friends with, right? Which it's obvious, and we all would recognize that if we look back to our own childhoods and did anything, let alone sport, let alone soccer. But that makes sense. So there are two points there. I think there's this sense of being in it together, regardless of hierarchy, and then hanging out together. I'm going to split those apart. Is India pretty hierarchical in advertising?
I would say yes. I think eventually a sense of power and sense of authority that comes with designation and salary packages and responsibility, of course, I think drives a lot of autonomous decision making. Like, you know, of course, certain individuals who are at those stages or holding on to those roles. Long story short, yes, it is hierarchical.
I've been to Bombay and I've taught a lot of people from India and I'm super curious about the country. But one thing that surprised me as I've traveled around, and not in a positive or negative way, is sometimes I'm in rooms or I'm talking with someone and maybe they're a pretty senior person. Let's call them a CEO or maybe even like a chairperson. And then in India, in my experience, which could be wrong, you start to learn that their brother is big in Bollywood. Their father like owned a factory that, you know, for me, there's these really big families that sort of are sitting on top of some of these really big agencies, not positive or negative. Again, am I making this up?
That's a bit rare, to be honest. I wouldn't necessarily kind of endorse that as the usual pattern. It can happen sometimes, of course. I think it's largely a bunch of professionals coming together, working for extended periods of time and rising the ladder on the back of the work that they've done, the back of the relationships that they've built. In some cases, of course, what you're calling out, of course, that happens.
Now, if we look at the 90%+ of relationships that maybe weren't as fulfilling as they could have been, instead of just saying the opposite of the two points that we've already said, what are some of the dynamics that come to mind when you think about those relationships?
I think a couple of things. One is perhaps our inability, and when I say our, I mean strategists, our inability to kind of match the frequency at which the creative person was operating, right? Either inability to match them intellectually or creatively. That's one common kind of sour point, often leading to unfulfilled relationships, for the lack of a better term. That's one thing. The other thing, which I think is very, very human and it gets played out in advertising agencies often, is ego comes in the way. And naturally, I think, and you were talking about football, Mark, earlier, I think the way this profession has come into being and the way we are kind of stacked in terms of account management strategists and creatives, creatives happen to be the strikers who are expected to score goals. Therefore, when it comes to strategists, at least my personal belief is they need to play the role of midfielders and make excellent assists so that, you know, the ball can be netted. And sometimes ego comes in the way and it can work both ways, right? Either the strategist wants to just go and score a goal on his own or on her own, or the creative just doesn't give you, you know, enough to kind of do the things that you're good at, right? And it just boils down to ego.
And just on that, there is research out there that shows that creativity and narcissism correlate. There's a slight correlation. It's not to say that all people who do creative work super, super, super narcissistic, but you do have to be slightly self-absorbed or very much in your head. And also you have to think that you're good enough to put something out into the world, generally speaking. The other thing that I think is worth pointing out before I get you to continue is when you look at the big five personality traits, people who do creative work tend to be high in openness, pretty high in conscientiousness, especially the ones who are really good, you know, because a lot of creative people are dealing with sometimes messy minds, not always dark emotions, but definitely messy minds. But you still have to be conscientious, work hard to get that, to put the stuff out into the world. A lot of creatives can be lower in agreeableness, maybe than strategists. I mean, that's not scientific, but, you know, a lot of creatives I've worked with, they are taught that they have to say no to a lot of things because everybody will destroy their idea. And then there's a little piece of research out there, and a lot of this stuff gets debunked in the social sciences, that creativity and extroversion are slightly correlated. So I just wanted to throw that in as you were getting into the ego thing, because I think for the upcoming strategist or maybe even the strategy boss who works with creative teams, it's worth understanding these dynamics, because if you can understand them in a relatively neutral way, then I think it helps you deal with them in a more constructive way. Like you don't have false expectations, for example.
The point that you're making about the personality types, it's perhaps naive to suggest that if the creative person is not open, he or she is the opposite of that. You know what I'm saying? That doesn't mean that person is closed. From what I have observed and I have learned over the years, especially from my mentors and kind of watching them in action in terms of how they nurtured these kind of relationships and partnerships, is that I think at some point we need to recognize the fact that creative people are very fragile people. And I don't mean that in a negative manner. And I think they are fragile because they carry the burden of creating something, birthing something. And of course, with research and several different techniques that's now available that tells us what is right and what is correct, what's going to move the market and what's going to be effective and all of that. And then, you know, of course, several rounds of feedback from, you know, internal stakeholders, external stakeholders, consumers, et cetera, et cetera. I think somewhere they're very, very scared that somebody will just come and smash their ideas. We need to protect the ideas per se, of course, because as Dan Wyden says, you know, the work comes first. But I think we need to protect those people as well. And when they realize that you're in the room not to piss on their creatives or their ideas, but you're actually trying to protect them in many different ways, I think that's where something special starts blooming. That's when they kind of, you know, going back to the friendship conversation that I was having earlier, they tend to respect that a lot, at least from my past experience.
Yeah. And again, there's no statistics on some of this stuff, but I get around, I talk to a lot of people and I do it in a freer way now because I'm not working in an agency. I'm sort of working outside of an agency, but I would expect that there's also a lot of complication with a lot of people in the creative teams and strategy teams that we don't always discuss. One is trauma, right? And again, I don't know if this is everywhere, but a lot of people I've come across, especially as we get older and we talk about life, have dealt with some pretty difficult things, whether it's, you know, growing up in a divorced household, which does affect you psychologically and biologically, through to more severe things. I'm not going to say it's the norm, but it's probably more common than in some of the other professions. There's also the incidence of ADHD. Maybe some people roll their eyes at that particular phrase. We've run sessions on ADHD. There's a lot of people who are quietly dealing with a manic brain, very fast moving brain. Depression, it's not, again, not saying it's common. My sense is that it's probably a little bit more common. And then, you know, one dynamic that strategists don't necessarily have to deal with, or maybe they don't understand, is that the creators play a different game. If they want to work at an agency like Wieden and Kennedy, and if they don't have good work every 3 to 6 months, at least every year, but I'm going to say every 3 to 6 months, their career is going to stall. Right? A strategist can kind of get away with being a little bit smart, maybe good to work with. And I don't mean get away with, but I do, being cheeky. And maybe their career can still progress. But with creatives, if their portfolio is empty, if their name's not on a thing, they don't get that career boost. They don't get the promotion, right? So there are different dynamics at play. Anything to respond to there or anything to add there?
You know, sometimes we famously distinguish between the fact that we are commercial artists and not necessarily artists in the pure play of the term. But I think when you kind of deal with creative minds and creative souls, I think that anxiety is quite palpable because, as you rightly said, they are under tremendous pressure on the back of growth, on the back of, you know, growing your portfolio, on the back of growing the account, growing the relationship, growing the agency, to put work out there that will make the brand famous and in turn them famous and in turn the agency famous. And it's not easy because, you know, in the aim of getting the work right, like I said, and the work correct, oftentimes the magic is lost.
Before we get into the building trust part of this, I just want to continue with where we were, which is let's describe some of the dynamics that you've seen when it just hasn't really worked. And you mentioned the inability to match the frequency creatively or intellectually, and then you mentioned ego. What else comes to mind?
I think this point that we are talking about is also relevant. Not being able to understand the emotional fragility of being a creative person. I think we need to recognize that, we need to respect that, and we need to kind of invest in understanding that a little bit more. What I mean by that is what I was saying earlier, like investing time outside of office, outside of briefs, outside of work conversations, to understand the person, their past, what is it that they enjoy as a human being, what kind of stimulus do they expect, right? When we are having a creative conversation or a work-driven conversation, personally, what are their strengths, right? What are their areas of improvement? What is it that gives them joy, right? I mean, when was the last time we just sat with creative people and just spoke about what are the kind of stuff that they want to do? The urgent stuff always kind of takes over the important stuff. And I'm afraid this kind of a dynamic, again, kind of acts as a barrier towards building that relationship.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have 3 membership levels, Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview. Well, there's something very practical that you can do. And by you, I don't mean a 24-year-old strategist, because the challenge with some of what we're talking about is strategy is very young right now, average age, very, very young. And so, you know, telling someone who's just starting out, who's scared about whether they're getting respected, scared about whether they'll get back invited back into a room to like catch up with a 40-year-old ECD or whatever, 50-year-old ECD, that's challenging. But one thing that someone who has some kind of quote-unquote power on a project can do is start a project off by saying, what do you all want to, as individuals, get out of this project? Because we know that's what people think about, so why not talk about it and then see if it's relevant to the project and then maybe help each other do it. It's super practical. Post-it notes up on the wall. Just go for two more so we get to five.
I think another thing that sometimes kind of can hurt the relationship is by nature, given the kind of business that we're in, I think we're very, very quick to judge people, right? And I don't mean this as an example of creative people judging people very quickly. I mean, all of us were in this business. Even strategists judge people very quickly. So do account management people. But I think what happens when you are kind of trying to build a partnership at whatever level with a creative individual, if you come across as being largely useless in many sense of that term, then I think the desire for a creative individual to have you in the room, to include you in meetings, conversations, brainstorms, whatever it is, largely to include you in their creative process diminishes very rapidly. Of course, the flip of that is, of course, try and be useful, which is something that, of course, we can speak about in detail as well. But that's something I think kind of stands out in terms of something that acts as a barrier between a creative and a strategist when it comes to building those relationships. And the last one, perhaps, and tell me if this makes sense and if it's useful. I think it helps because we are dealing with creative minds and they are not necessarily sometimes or, you know, more often than not, very proficient in number crunching, understanding data, understanding complicated categories, understanding complicated business structures. I think it helps when we start a project if we are able to kind of give them a good understanding of what is the problem that we're trying to solve, because I think there's great value in that. And again, if strategists kind of skip that step and directly get into, well, here's a bunch of insights, or here's what the client really wants, or here's a great TV idea, can we talk about this? I think they get thrashed later on because they're not necessarily responding to a problem that the client is invested in. When the clients come to us, they don't come to us because they have millions of dollars to burn. They come to us because they want to affect change. And I think it's important for creatives to understand that problem in a very, very simple manner so that, again, they can do the best job of their lives. So sometimes not getting that problem right can also hurt.
I agree with that. Put you on the spot. Can you think of a problem from the past few years of your career, whether it's been you or a strategist you've worked with or even a creative team who's defined the problem? Can you give us an example that has struck you?
I think sometimes what happens is when clients come to us, and oftentimes they kind of tend to overload the brief with multiple problems to be solved. Right? That's a classic kind of pattern, which I'm sure you must have kind of noticed in your career. I think if we don't get to the heart of the problem, or as we call it in Widen internally, the big honest problem, right? What's the honest problem that we are after? Because having multiple problems in the brief looks great for the brand manager, but it doesn't look great for the strategist or the creative. You know, it's like throwing multiple tennis balls at you. You won't be able to catch multiple balls. I think it's critical that we identify which is the one that we want to go after. And sometimes that can be a good example of a problem definition.
One of the most common things that I see right now when I work with in-house teams and agencies is the marketing briefs are not very useful. They could be 3 to 10 pages that loaded up with data. There's no thread. There's no through point. It's just a collection of information. And I feel for everyone involved because the person or the people who put that together, they're doing what they think they need to do to unlock budget, to get respect in their own organizations. But you look at these things and a lot of the teams I work with, especially in-house teams, who it's not that in-house teams are more trapped, okay, but I think there's a different kind of pressure on them where they have to make it work because they have one client. And I'll look at these briefs with them. I'm like, there's like one or two things that you might be able to take out of this 3 to 10 page brief, which is perhaps a slightly sharpened point of view on the audience and maybe a slightly sharpened point of view on an objective. But really these documents, a lot of them, not all of them, a lot of them come in and I'm like, oh my gosh, how do you work with that? One, and two, depending on your culture, maybe pretend that it was a useful document and refer to it in the future as being useful, even though it wasn't. So, let's talk about building trusting relationships because you've put some thought into this between strategists and creatives. Where do you want to start? How do you do that?
I think if you remember that scene in Kung Fu Panda, right? When the master asks you to jump, you just jump. You don't necessarily think about what will happen. Will I fall? Will I break my bones? Blah, blah, blah. I think the core of building trust in any relationship, and especially so in our industry between a strategist and creative, is having faith. And this needs to work both ways. I don't think it's the one-way street that just the strategists need to keep doing it. I think the creatives also need to have kind of faith in strategists that, yes, if they are leading me towards this path, you know, they've done the homework, they've done everything that they need to do. And I have faith, which is why, again, I go back to the metaphor of friendships, because one core thing with friends is that you have faith that they got your back. Even if you jump and even if there's no trampoline, once you fall, they will carry you. They will hold you, right? They'll find some way to protect you. So I think having that faith is very, very important. And again, it can't happen overnight. It can't happen sometimes because of age gaps, like we were talking about earlier. Very easy to kind of put these things out there, but very difficult, for example, for a young strategist or a mid-level strategist to build faith with, say, a very, very senior creative leader. But I think if we invest in, you know, having those conversations with them regularly about work, about inspiration, about stimulus, about what's keeping you awake at night, how can I help, how can I be useful, at some point they realize that, you know, you're just trying to help them. That again, in turn, I think helps build faith, much like in any relationships, in my opinion.
What else helps to build trust?
I think one of the things, and this is really odd, but I'll still say it. I think sometimes when things don't go the way we planned it, you have a very, very bad meeting, or you've worked on a particular brief for 3 weeks and then, you know, you've done some work and then you can it because you don't believe in it anymore, or any sort of accidents that happen in the process. I think that helps build trust, because when that happens, much like in life, when something bad happens to us in our lives, the people who stand by us and help us kind of cope with that and emerge out of that obviously gain our respect and a special place in our hearts. So I think the ability to kind of stand by your people, not just creative people, everybody who you work with across departments, it helps build that trust.
What have you seen people do, or what do you suspect people do when things are not going so well? What sort of patterns do you think are pretty common that maybe we can get out of?
In terms of things to avoid or things to do?
Things to avoid. So for example, you know, I've worked in places that were very aggressive with having meetings the day after a pitch or the day after a pitch loss. And it was just super unnecessary. Like, we're going to have this learning moment, but it just felt you were being, you know, investigated by your advertising parents and nobody felt good about it at all.
One of the top things to avoid in that kind of a context in terms of where something has gone wrong is to just kind of go away and hide. I think that doesn't help anyone. If you've been in a meeting or you've come out of a pitch, you didn't win, or just a bad meeting, I think people tend to also vanish to kind of process that and kind of figure out, how do I show up? There's a sense of shame. There's a sense of anxiety. There's imposter syndrome, of course, which plagues strategists severely across the planet. But I think what helps is to talk about, you know, what went wrong, instead of interrogating and doing a postmortem of why it went wrong. Of course, there's a time and place for that as well. But just generally reflecting upon what went wrong and focusing perhaps on what we could have done better and what are the learnings from it as individuals, not necessarily as a unit to get our, you know, act together in the next pitch, but just generally, what the fuck did we learn out of this as a team? I think that conversation is greatly respected by creative people.
I think you can have a moment between projects where you have that conversation, but because it can be a little bit awkward and because people can be licking their wounds a little bit, again, you could bring that question or one of those questions into the next pitch, which is, what are we going to do differently this time? Like, it doesn't have to be what's right, wrong, what worked, what didn't. It's like, what are three things we're going to do differently this time? Which implies, what have we learned over the past few months? So again, that can be brought into a project so it feels practical. And then what I would encourage someone running the project to do is to put that stuff up on a wall, physical or virtual, and make sure that it's public and people see it so they realize that we're trying to develop this self-improving organism, right? As opposed to post-mortem, people get not told off, but like there's obviously sometimes an implication of like, you know, don't do this again, naughty boy, naughty girl. That doesn't help. Doesn't help, right?
Yeah, yeah. Apart from the underlining that you're putting on what can we do differently next time or what can we do different, I think the operating word there is also we, because we tend to get into this accusatory mode when something goes wrong. You fucked it up. I told you, you shouldn't have been doing this. I told you, I read the client, I read the room. I think that doesn't help. That face-off doesn't help. We're in it together. This is a team. We'll take a bullet for each other. I think that's the kind of environment that helps people, especially creative people and every other single individual working for the agency or the organization, feel that they truly belong, feel that this is one team, and feel, most importantly, that they can fail. Like Dan Wyden famously said, fail harder. If we kind of legitimize that and live that out every day of our lives, it makes for a better team, more meaningful team.
Give me one more way that we can build trust with creatives.
Having a drink with them. When you go out to a pub, I generally just chill out with them and have a drink. I think the guards come down, the masks come off, because then you're just two individuals having a drink and having a conversation. And I think that helps. And if you don't drink, then have coffee, have tea, whatever it is that floats your boat. But if you make that time to just have that conversation at an individual level, I think that helps outside of the office environment. If you do this within the office environment, in my experience at least, it doesn't help that much.
True, true, true. And not to be pro-drinking, but there is a book called Drunk, and it tracks the history of alcohol in the world. And a lot of cultures, if you didn't drink alcohol, people wouldn't trust you. Yeah, so we're not saying to do it, but if you're curious about the history of it and how it has affected social cultures and maybe even agriculture and the fact that humans farmed in places, because apparently a lot of that was due to wanting alcohol, there's a good book called Drunk. We did set up something earlier, one final topic that I want to get into very quickly, just about being useful versus useless. Let's go for three. I like my lists. Three ways that a strategist can be more useful from today.
I think, like we spoke about earlier, and just tell me if you want me to add more points, because we did speak about this in a smaller context earlier, which is, you know, helping creative get to the heart of the problem. That's a super useful way of being useful. That is an area where a creative or a bunch of creatives need help, because that's their starting point. That's where we start. That's where the gun goes off. If the starting point is wrong and we've not investigated enough or critiqued the brief enough or tried to go underneath the stated problem enough, whether it's the stated consumer problem or the stated client problem or whatever it is that's documented in the brief, then we've got the wrong start, and that doesn't help. That is frustrating for a creative person, because you've spent weeks, you've spent months in some cases, you've built something, you've crash tested it, pressure tested it, got feedback on it, only to realize you were wrong all the way because somebody told you to take a road which you should never have taken. That's number one for me in terms of being useful. I think the second way of being useful is getting multiple perspectives in the room in terms of problem solving or unlocking creativity. The strategist also is trying to kind of shepherd the creative thinking towards a particular channel or towards a particular direction. So we tend to get very unidimensional, especially if we hit gold early on and we believe that's the right thing to do. Then we just keep running on that track till the time the creative teams are convinced that that's a great track to run on. I think what helps creative people is to show them multiple tracks and the pros and cons of running on those tracks. And what happens if we go on this particular track versus the other tracks? That's largely the nature of strategy, right? I mean, figuring out different ways and what can work, what may work. And of course, taking a collective kind of educated guess on what is most likely to be effective. I think they appreciate that. Very rarely in my life have I seen strategists walk into a room and say, this is where you go and off you go and that's it. Thank you very much. I think you need to spend time with them, show them different ways of solving that problem. It could happen in various ways. It could, you know, come from your life, come from anecdotes, come from consumers, come from a story, come from a book, come from a podcast. It doesn't matter where it comes from. But you need to kind of feed their minds with different ways of solving that problem. Because I think what happens when they kind of walk out of that conversation and stay with the problem, I think their brain kind of hits different neurons in terms of cross connections. And those unexpected cross connections often yield great creative ideas.
I like that. I have a feeling that what you just said, which is very natural to me, it's how I like to work, share things early, often hand-drawn little conversations here and there, if you can get access to people. That's very natural, right? But I feel like in some places, especially in like the in-house teams, there's so much pressure on having like bulletproof insights, data-driven insights, basically things together in a way that the company feels will definitely lead to success. And that kind of culture to me doesn't appreciate the humanity and the messy humanity that you described that I feel very drawn to. Have you seen that at play in the agency world? Because I definitely see it at play in the in-house world.
Yeah, it plays out in the agency world as well. And I think part of our job as strategists, again, is to protect the creative people from that shit show. Data is okay. Nobody's saying we shouldn't be looking at data. Insights, well, it's probably the most fetishized word in this industry. But I think what the creatives are looking for is an opening, right? They're looking for an entry point that will get them somewhere, that will help them to imagine something that has not been done before, that will help, you know, the work become famous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if the conversation is all about data and insights and bullet points and RTBs, reason to believe, it doesn't work. My advice or my suggestion would be to keep it in the back pocket and bring it out when we need to kind of defend the work or sell the work. But I don't think that's ever going to be the core, because from time immemorial and for the future to come, it's going to be about having the ability to tell wonderful stories. You know, wonderful stories have to come from human spaces. It can come from sociology, evolutionary biology, it can come from culture, doesn't matter where it comes from. But I think the moment we kind of burden that narrative with big data, small data, this data, that data, I don't think that helps a creative mind.
Let's do one more point. So we've got get to the heart of the problem, show multiple tracks or multiple starting points or possibilities. Third way for a strategist to be more useful to a creative team.
I think being with them constantly through that journey, because it's a process, right? And many creatives might deny having a quote-unquote process that they follow to kind of birth an idea. But no matter how messy it is and how chaotic it is a process, unfortunately, right? There's certain ways that have been defined and we need to go through the hoops. You know, the brief comes in, there's account management, appreciation of the brief, strategists get into the room, further appreciation, investigation, interrogation, consumer work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we reach towards the end of that tunnel when the creative engine kind of gets in and you start having that conversation. And then the creative person or the creative team has their own kind of processes. I think it hurts when you leave them alone and just walk away, right? Saying, you know, I've done a lot of work and here it is. Here's the big insight. Here's the big data that you were looking for, or whatever it is that you've baked into your brief or pitch or whatever it is. I think it helps to kind of hold their hand and stay with them and check in with them regularly, even if informally. You don't need to call big committees to kind of check in with them. Just have a conversation with them. Water cooler conversation, corridor conversation, whatever. What's going on? What are you thinking? You know, hey, this is something that came to my mind last night and I was having a chat. What do you feel about this? It kind of demonstrates to them that you're equally invested in that creative process. And therefore, you know, you have stake in it. You have skin in the game. Your strategy is a creative act. It gives them comfort that, you know, this is a person that I can turn to and can discuss and share and help build, instead of this somebody who's come in and is probably going to vanish and go off to their own caves. And the next time I see them, we'll be in a room where everybody's going to bring out their swords to evaluate my idea.
And that, look, there will be people that you all work with out there who don't want to talk with you as they're having ideas, who, when they present ideas internally, don't want your thoughts. I don't like the word feedback, by the way, but they don't want your thoughts. And also people in the creative department who really just see you, strategist, as a way to sell in their idea. That frustrates me a lot when I've seen that kind of dynamic where there's no real intellectual exchange. And then there's like, well, you can help us sell this in. And I find that super patronizing. You're going to have all kinds of relationships, but hopefully if you get 15 to 20 that are good out of 500, that seems like I relate pretty much to that ratio, to be honest. And then, you know, if you are in those relationships right now, you could be peak career, you know, and I think that's one thing a lot of strategists who are in high performing companies or agencies, maybe with a handful of creatives that they like to work with. Maybe there's an excellent group account director who's really good with clients and they get on with that client and they're all trying to do something good. You might have that a couple of times in your career. And if you're having it right now, you should cherish it. And if you haven't had it, it is available, although the world is very stressed right now. Anibhan, where's the best place for people to find you on the internet?
LinkedIn, Twitter.
Well, I really appreciate you chatting with me today. I feel like we did about four or five podcast episodes in one, and hopefully a lot of chunky information for people out there. And, you know, I'm fortunate to travel to a lot of different places. And one of the things that I love is being able to have this kind of conversation and relate to it in like a kind of like a deeply soulful way for me. And I know that might sound strange because we're talking about work and strategy, etc. But for me, we're not, because for a lot of us, we do this work, we stumble into it and we're like, oh my God, this is how my brain and my personality can exist. And so when I'm having like an interaction with someone that I really relate to, it's just like, you know, I made a friend in the way that a three-year-old kid in a playground in New York would go over to the slippery slide, crash, someone would pick them up, a four-year-old, and they'd come back to us as parents and go, I just made a friend. So Anibhan, I just made a friend.
Same here, Mark. Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation and love the stuff that you're doing. Been a great fan of yours, continue to be a fan of yours. Spotted you at the DNAD Curious Festival, I think, once you were in Mumbai, along with Dave Trott, Vicky, and the gang. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, planning to get back out to India. I'd love to do it early next year, 2024. But if that doesn't happen, then sometime in 2024 or 2025, I want to do some big stuff because it's just such good energy there. Anibhan, thank you so much for joining me here on Sweathead today.
Thanks, Mark. Cheers.
Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.